We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, the 2025 Columbus Air Show has been chosen by the U.S. Navy to be part of its Navy Week program. Only 15 cities were honored nationally, and our Jay Fox will have more. Jay will also talk with an expert about solar jobs in Ohio, and he has a warning about Gen Z and digital eye strain. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
The city of Columbus has been chosen as one of 15 cities nationwide for the U.S. Navy's Navy Week program. The U.S. Navy selected Columbus and the 2025 Columbus Air Show to showcase naval assets. The Columbus Air Show in Central Ohio will serve as the centerpiece to the United States Navy's efforts to promote naval excellence and spur recruitment in 2025 as part of their annual Navy Week program. This year's air show will be August 22nd through the 24th at Rickenbacker International Airport. And Herb Gillen, who produces this event, joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
This will be the third air show since the reboot in 2023. How did the Navy come to select the show in Columbus to promote much-needed recruitment?
That's a great question. It came as a bit of a surprise to us, actually. We knew we had the U.S. Navy Blue Angels here. We've known that for about 2 years. And then earlier this year, we got a call from the Navy saying, hey, we'd like to make Columbus a Navy Week, and we'd like to kind of have the air show be the centerpiece of that. So we said, yeah, that's great. The reasons that they come to Columbus, this is an opportunity for the Navy to kind of get into the heartland. If you live on the coast, you're more likely to encounter sailors and be near a base. But, if you're in the Midwest, there's just not as many naval assets. So this is an opportunity for them to get out, and it's a chance for recruiting and a chance for just, the general public to get to be face-to-face with sailors, naval aviators. The great thing for the air show is that this comes with quite a bit of support. We have, of course, the Blue Angels, but the U.S. Navy F-35 Lightning demo team is also coming, which, if you get the Blue Angels, it's very rare that you're also going to get a single ship Navy demonstration. So we're real excited about having that. And then all of the ground display stuff, the Navy Strike Force exhibit, which is a big interactive display, allowing our guests to get up and kind of experience for a brief moment different careers within the Navy. We're going to have probably close to 100 sailors, naval aviators, all sorts of Navy folks at the show that will be there in uniform talking to people, discussing the Navy.
Now, you produce air shows all over the country. Are any of your other shows going to include the Navy like this?
We have a show we're doing in Branson, Missouri, over Labor Day weekend that has also been Branson's Springfield area is going to be a Navy Week. So it's, as you said, it's kind of rare. I think there's 15 Navy Weeks throughout the country, and so we're getting to do two of them, which is kind of neat.
In terms of attendance, what does the naval endorsement do for a show like this? Do we need to quickly build some more hotels in Columbus?
Well, I can say 2 years ago when we relaunched the show and had the U.S. Navy Blue Angels, we sold out of all 3 days. And we have a capacity, and primarily it's parking capacity at the airport. So once we get to about 5,000 vehicles, we have to cut it off. And we will sell out. We're getting pretty close to sold out for Saturday's show already. Sunday is approaching that. We still have plenty of tickets available for Friday. But, you know, we would expect probably 50 to 55,000 people over the course of the weekend.
What does it cost to get into the show this year, Herb?
Well, there's a variety of ticket options, including general admission tickets, which, depending on which day you're looking at, are in the $30 to $40 range. I should mention kids 15 and under are free in general admission. We also have a military discount for active duty and veterans. But we also have premium seating options. A lot of those are sold out already, but they can involve, you know, tented areas and buffet lunches and bar service. So, kind of different options for what you're looking to do.
Is this something that's appropriate for young children, or is it too loud?
It's absolutely appropriate. Now, we would encourage ear protection because it can get loud. Anywhere from, 2-3 year old and up, there's something to do and that they're going to love. Lots of hands-on stuff. We've got several dozen aircraft that will be on the ground, some of which our guests can get in, crawl through, get in the cockpit. Others, they may have to stand back a ways from things like the F-22 Raptor. But just a lot of fun stuff. We've got a STEM area, Experience STEM in Aviation, which is presented by NetJets, and it's helped produced by the Ohio State Aviation School. We've got probably 40 different hands-on STEM activities in that STEM area, which can help expose especially children to different careers in aviation and technology. We've got the kids' zone play area with bounce houses and climbing walls and that sort of thing. So there'll be a lot to do. It's an all-day event, but you can come out for a little bit or come out for all day.
Now, if folks want to go buy those Friday tickets or learn more about the show, what's the best website?
ColumbusAirshow.com has all the information you need. You can buy your tickets there. In fact, that's the only place that you can buy the tickets. As I mentioned, we've got different ticket options, but some of the, especially Saturday, is all the premium seats are sold out.
The 2025 Columbus Air Show, one of 15 cities nationally for the U.S. Navy Week program. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Ohio ranks 12th nationally in solar capacity, with over 5.6 gigawatts installed, enough to power more than 700,000 homes. The solar industry supports more than 8,000 Ohioans and has driven home more than $6.3 billion, that's billion with a B, in local investment. Ohio has become the number one solar manufacturing hub in the United States. New analysis from the Solar Energy Industries Association reveals that federal legislation now advancing in Congress could devastate Ohio's rapidly growing solar industry, and that would threaten thousands of local jobs, billions in economic investment, and the reliability of the state's power grid. Abigail Ross Hopper is the president and CEO of the Solar Energy Industries Association, and she joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Jay.
Good morning. This is a very important topic. How would this legislation specifically impact all of these solar jobs in our state?
Yeah, this legislation would take away the tax credits that the solar and storage industry have utilized for a couple of decades. And most importantly, the business certainty that our companies have come to rely on. So almost overnight, kind of the rules of engagement will have changed, and companies will have to start laying off workers and closing factories. As you said, about 5,600 jobs are at risk. About 21 factories would close their doors in the state of Ohio.
So when we talk about the workers at those factories, what workers are we talking about specifically? Who's really at risk?
Yeah, honestly, folks that are working in solar manufacturing facilities, folks that are up on roofs using those products and saving homeowners money, men and women that are, you know, on top of your favorite Target, your favorite Walmart, your favorite Starbucks, who are building capacity. We're also talking about the people that are working in AI, right, that are building the data centers, that are working at the data centers, that are working at the tech companies, because we cannot have data centers. We cannot win AI if we do not have access to inexpensive, reliable electricity, and solar and storage are inexpensive, reliable electricity.
So you mentioned a potential $51 billion spike in electric bills, and we're sitting here in Columbus, Ohio, looking at a spike from American Electric Power, AEP, just for the summer months alone. Mm-hmm. How would that $51 billion spike translate into our, you know, monthly bills?
Yeah, well, it would be over $100 a year for families, for the average family. So that would be yet another, you know, 10 bucks or so when you open that electricity bill. And as you said, there are, you know, this is a cascading issue. So there are spikes for the summer months. There's spikes because of the capacity market. There are spikes because of this potential legislation. And those add up and really impact bills for families.
When you talk about the bill affecting reliability of the power grid, I remember, and I'm an old timer, I remember when Silicon Valley was built, and I remember all of the rolling brownouts and blackouts in Southern and Northern California. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about that kind of problem during peak seasons, like summer when you're running the AC full blast, or, you know, it gets cold in Ohio, winter where you need the heat?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we are talking about a risk like that. Solar and storage were 82% of the new capacity on the grid so far in 2025. It is what utilities are building, right? It is the cheapest and the most reliable and the fastest to grid. And so if we take away this certainty that companies have and they are not able to build, that's going to impact all of us, because on those coldest days when everyone has the heat on, or those warmest days when everyone has the air conditioner on, there's just literally not going to be enough power. And so that is a risk for all of us.
Well, and you also mentioned the power that was not just needed to power a neighborhood or a typical downtown, but as all of these data centers are coming into Central Ohio, mm-hmm. all of the reports suggest that they need a tremendous amount of grid power.
That's so, exactly right.
So that's going to drive up demand. And of course, you know, the laws of economics, as demand increases, price increases with it.
That's right. Yes. So, you know, the data centers coming, winning the AI race against China is an important priority for the United States. And we have to mitigate the impact of those rate increases. And one way to do that is to continue to have access to solar and storage. The, you know, the tech companies that are building these need power, they need it fast, and they need huge amounts of it. And so, you know, we really need to make sure that as a nation, for our energy security and our national security, we have access to every electron possible.
So before we get into the broader details about how this could impact the entire country, for those of us in Central Ohio who are homeowners or perhaps own apartment buildings or small retail complexes, should we be considering supplementing our own personal energy use now by putting solar on our roofs?
Now is a great time to install solar on the roof and to add batteries with it so that you have even more reliability and resiliency. I mean, the one thing we know about electricity prices is that they go up, right? And solar and storage are one of the few ways that business owners and homeowners have to control and reduce their electricity bills.
Let's get into the meat of the national matter. Every administration comes with a different set of policies regarding the environment. Clean energy was a huge priority for the Biden administration, perhaps not as much of a priority for the current administration. So what role does solar manufacturing play in clean energy and economic strategy?
Yeah, well, you know, I just look at what our president says about American energy dominance, right? American energy dominance means that we own the generation, we own the manufacturing, that we are owning AI. And in order to do that, we need every source of electricity. So this is not a, like, you know, an either or sort of one technology against the other. This is a all hands on deck. We need every electron, we need every technology source. And it's so solar and storage, kind of the individual reliability, the personal freedom that comes with it, are entirely in line with the president's view of American energy dominance.
So if we move towards complete vertical integration of energy in the United States, and these 331 factories are forced to shut down or new factories may never open, mm-hmm. What's going to happen?
You know what's going to happen? A lot of people will lose their jobs. We will get a lot of our product from overseas. China is the number one manufacturer of solar products in the world. The U.S. is number three for modules. So we are basically just handing a victory to China and to other countries. That's what will happen, and that's why we are so vigorously fighting this, because we really believe that Ohioans and Americans are the best positioned to manufacture solar products.
I remember being a school student many, many years ago when Three Mile Island had its crisis. Now they're talking about reopening Three Mile Island and doubling down on nuclear power plants. A, is that enough to satisfy the demand if solar goes away? And B, what about the safety factor? Has anything changed?
So it's definitely, let me just say, it shows you how hungry the tech companies are for new power, right? That things that might have seemed unimaginable are absolutely on in discussion. Reopening Three Mile Island, I drive by it whenever I go north. That is wild, right, to many of us that we might reopen it. But it just shows you how important it is that this country needs to utilize every resource we have at our disposal. I will leave the safety of nukes to others who are much more expert on that than I am. But I will say that, as I said, solar and storage can provide that. Not alone. It's naive to think any one technology could deliver that kind of capacity all by itself.
Is there ever been any discussion about specific technologies for specific purposes? For example, we use solar for this, we use wind for that, we use coal for this, we use nuclear power for that.
Not really. It is not really reflective of how the electric grid works. I mean, there's obviously certainly, you know, nuclear-powered submarines and things like that. But the way that our system has been designed, once the electron is created, it is available wherever the grid needs it. I will say the one exception to that is it's called behind the meter. So you have it on site, right? You have solar and storage at your home, or you have solar and storage on your factory or on your, on your convenience store. But our grid is designed so that all technologies come together to make this system work.
So for the average person that just comes home and flips the light switch on and the lights go on and they say, nope, good enough, how do you inform the general public about this? Because it doesn't seem like the general public understands the severity of the situation and the timing of that severity.
Yeah. It's a great question. And, you know, before I did this work, I was one of those people that came home, flipped on my electricity, and then sort of gasped when the bill came every month. But I think, you know, doing what you're doing, talking to folks about the jobs, I think a lot of people are surprised by how many people in Ohio work in the solar industry. I think they're surprised because it's happened so rapidly. The AI demand, and every single person has to pay an electricity bill. And so, you know, sort of using that as a way to enter the conversation, because it is all of us have to do that, is one way that we can have this conversation.
The Solar Energy Industries Association is advocating right now to get Congress to do something different. What do you want to see Congress do instead of what they're doing?
No, we would like to see Congress recognize the importance that solar and storage play in American energy dominance and provide a more stable ramp down of these tax credits. As I said, the current proposal changes things overnight, literally overnight, so that you started 2025 with one business plan, and by the middle of the year, everything is gone. That's a terrible way to do business development, economic development, manufacturing policy in the U.S. So we're asking Congress to provide a more stable ramp down so that businesses can pivot and sort of look for new markets and adjust. But the way it's currently stated, it would be an overnight change that would be devastating.
So for the folks that are listening at home or in their car or wherever they are right now, scratching their head saying, what in the world is Jay Fox talking about now? Where, right? Where can we send them to a website that provides information in layman's terms so that the general public can understand?
Yeah. So it's a super easy website, solarpowersamerica.org. Solarpowersamerica.org. It has a lot of information about what's at stake, and it has actions that your listeners can take to let their legislators know that they care about this. They do not want their energy bills to rise by $51 billion collectively.
You know, I specifically ask for my electric bill to be paper, even though that annoys the power company to death. But the reason I want that is that within those paper bills, they actually tell you where your power is coming from. Mm. And they also provide a chart as to how much more you're paying this month than last month.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we take our energy sources for granted. And I think this has been a tremendous and very helpful education as to what's going on in real time right now. So thank you, Abigail Ross Hopper, for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
It is estimated that there are almost 160,000 Gen Zers living here in Columbus. These are the folks born between 1997 and 2012. They've spent their entire lives in front of multiple screens with a negative impact on their vision. That leaves a lot of high school and college kids in need of eye exams before school starts. Gen Alpha, or those born between 2012 and 2024, will also face similar problems. Dr. Janelle Davison joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about the increasing challenges that these young people face when it comes to taking care of their eyes. Good morning.
Good morning.
How often do kids need an eye exam? Is it every year or every other year?
I recommend a that kids get an eye exam every year. It's important because we know now that increased time on screen in the classroom and outside of the classroom can have an impact on your child's vision. So the probability from year to year that your child's vision can change. So it's important to have their eyes evaluated with the eye care provider once a year is what I recommend.
Have we figured out how much screen time is too much before it starts to cause problems?
That's a great question. We're still learning. Most research recommends that kids spend at least 2 hours on the screen, but they're doing way more than that with school. So we do know that screen time can impact their vision, particularly digital eye strain. So it's important when kids are spending time on devices that we have contact lenses and glasses that can address their needs while they're on their screen.
What damage is done to the eyes with too much screen time, and can it be corrected, or does it require the addition of glasses or contact lenses, as you mentioned?
That's a great question. So it's important for your child to start with an annual eye exam so their eyes can be evaluated to see if they have an underlying prescription. We've learned that children who have up-to-date eye exams and have up-to-date glasses or contact lenses, prescriptions for glasses or contact lenses, improve on their reading and math scores. We are not quite sure about any damage that the computer does, but we do know it causes a lot of strain. So if your child wants to, say, for instance, wear contact lenses while they're on the computer, it's important to have contact lenses that take this digital strain into account. There are daily disposable lenses by Alcon, particularly Precision One, that works really well to help improve your child's vision while they're on the computer for hours of comfort. These contact lenses allow 8 hours of comfort on the computer, as well as these contact lenses provide blue light filtering properties. So I tell my patients, for contacts and glasses, we understand the impact of screens on their vision. And so we now have tools, even contact lenses, that can address their needs while they're on the computer. And then lastly, if they're so still interested in contact lenses, but they're not able to wear a daily disposable lens, we even now have weekly contact lenses with a special system that's called ActiveFlow that allows this child to be on the computer for over 16 hours and the contact lens will still perform for comfort and precise vision. So we have a lot of options available in glasses and contact lenses that address this digital world that we're in now.
Is there an advantage to wearing contacts over glasses, or is it just personal preference?
That's a great question. With children, particularly high school age and college age, and even middle school students who are very active, glasses versus contact lenses, one is just going to allow a little bit more flexibility. So if your child is very active in certain hobbies like basketball or drawing, then contacts sometimes are going to allow a wider field of vision. They're not going to slip down the nose. They're not going to fog up. They're just going to allow that child to be more active and not be bothered by their glasses on their face. And then also for kids, there's some kids who just do not like wearing glasses. So contact lenses are going to give them a little bit more options to have flexibility. But it's not necessarily one over the other. But if you have a very active lifestyle, then contacts are really a great option for your child.
How young is too young for contacts? I know that it requires having the ability to put them in and take them out and take care of them.
That is a great question. We used to think kids had to be a lot older. When I first started wearing contacts, I was 16 years old. But nowadays, we've made it so much easier for contacts for kids earlier. Single-use, daily disposable contact lenses take the thought out of it. Kids wear for that activity. Typically, these contacts are going to allow over 8 hours of comfort. They take into account the time they spend on a device or a tablet to still perform well. Once they're done, they're just thrown right in the trash. So I sit children as young as 10 years of age. But still, that's going to be up to the parent, the child, and their eye doctor. So I definitely encourage you, if you're thinking about your child being a good candidate for contact lenses, to ask your child, number one, to make sure they have interest. But then, two, also schedule an appointment with the eye care provider. They can help you better understand what technologies are available for your child and their active lifestyle.
Is there any truth to the rumor that eating more carrots helps your eyesight?
Yeah, carrots, leaf leafy green vegetables, healthy fats of the diet, like omegas, all those things. I jokingly say my parents tell me whatever you eat for your body that's going to be healthy, it helps with the odds. And so any vitamin A, vitamin D, omega-3, lutein, all those things are good for the body, but also the eyes. The eyes do not live on the island. They are part of your body. So all of those things are healthy for the entire body, but also for helping to protect and preserve your vision. It's all about total health, including ocular health.
We do various exercises to keep other parts of our body strong and in condition for activity and use. Are there eye exercises that we can do?
I get this question a lot from my patients. And so technically we don't have research on eye muscle exercises that we can do unless you have certain diagnosed eye conditions. And that's a side note, maybe amblyopia or a weak, a lazy eye. But in general, to protect your vision, to reduce clarity, we don't have eye muscle exercises you can do. However, if you spend time on the computer, research has shown that on the computer you blink less. So I encourage my patients to do blink exercises. About every 15 to 20 minutes, I recommend they do like 5 hard blinks with a squeeze. That's going to allow them to catch up on blinks that they miss out in that hour or so. Research has shown that reduction in blinking at the computer causes a digital eye strain and dryness. And also another tip, I allow my patients or recommend my patients look every 20 minutes, look 20 feet away for 20 seconds. So that way they can just change their focal point. But we don't have direct eye muscle exercises that can improve your vision per se in general.
For parents who are listening to this broadcast, what is a good website they can go to learn more about what we discussed this morning?
Yeah, so to learn more about contacts that take it to digital technology, they can visit precision.myalcon.com.
Precision.myalcon.com, correct? All right. We want to thank Dr. Janelle Davison for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
An effort to enshrine equal rights in the Ohio Constitution. The grassroots organization, Ohio Equal Rights, has decided to move forward with 2 separate constitutional amendments. The group will now have to collect more than 400,000 valid voter signatures from 44 of Ohio's 88 counties to get each of the proposed measures on a future ballot for you, the voter, to decide. Here's how we got to this point. On July 9th, the Ohio Ballot Board voted 3-2 along party lines to split the group's proposed constitutional amendment into 2 separate amendments. The original proposal would have prohibited discrimination based on race, religion, sexual orientation, disability, and a dozen other categories, including pregnancy status, age, recovery status, national origin, and military or veteran status. The proposed amendment also called for the repeal of Ohio's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. The Constitution now defines marriage as only between a man and a woman. Joining me now to talk about the effort to get these 2 amendments on the ballot is Ohio Equal Rights co-chair Lise Regula. Lise, thanks for being here today. I really appreciate it. Certainly. Well, let's start there. What was the focus of your discussions in deciding to go forward with 2 amendments?
So we tend to be data-driven. So first order of business after the decision was to figure out exactly what it would cost as far as additional printing costs, legal fees, and time for our options.
Mm-hmm.
From that, we were able to put together a survey and hold a town hall asking the community their input,
mm-hmm.
putting forward the information we had gathered, asking what they thought would be the best course of action if they were in our shoes.
And did you just decide basically that challenging the ballot board's decision would take too long in the courts or be too much work?
It would be added time, yes. It would also be added cost, and we're not sure of what the outcome would be. With a 6-1 Ohio Supreme Court, there's not certainty that the single issue would have been upheld in the way that precedent has previous to now.
Okay, I see. So the ballot board decided 3-2, as I mentioned, to split the amendment, saying the anti-discrimination list and the effort to repeal the constitutional ban on same-sex marriage were 2 separate issues. Can you see their reasoning in that vote? that those are two separate things?
I can see the argument that some folks can and do make that marriage equality is separate than individual rights. At the same time, people are social organisms. We have relationships, not just romantic, but also platonic and familial. And if I am restricted in how I can engage in relationships with another individual, then to my understanding and to our organization's belief, that really restricts how I as an individual can interact with the world.
So the big picture here, mm-hmm. What is this effort all about?
The effort is about protecting Ohioans. Yes, we do want to have those Equal Rights Amendment language in our state constitution.
And it's not there right now.
No. Currently, the language, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it boils down to all men are created equal. Oratorically great, legally doesn't really give a lot of guidance as to how that plays out in our day-to-day life, which is why Ohioans often have to rely on federal protections. As we're seeing those federal protections change and shift in real time, especially now with Kim Davis coming up in the news again, it's become more obvious that as a state, it is important for us to have recourse to be able to uphold our values and our priorities and our rights at a state level as well. That's not just a moral issue, it's also an economic issue. How many Ohioans have the time and money to go up to the federal Supreme Court?
Mm-hmm. What's Kim Davis? What's that about?
So Kim Davis was the, I believe, West Virginia clerk who made national news a number of years ago because she was refusing to issue marriage certificates to same-sex couples. That was part of the lead up to what eventually got us to Obergefell versus Hodges, mm-hmm. and put same-sex marriage as an equal issue across the U.S.
And you mentioned Obergefell, the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that legalized same-sex marriage. It was based on an Ohio case. Is part of this effort now and the timing because there's been some talk about possibly overturning the Obergefell ruling?
Yes, and this is, while I highlight Kim Davis's recent reemergence, this is not necessarily a new thing. In the Dobbs decision, the Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, mm-hmm. Obergefell was listed as a case that possibly could be reevaluated under this new Supreme Court, new at that point.
All right, so looking at this practically now, where do you go from here? What do you have to do? What's it going to take to get this on the ballot?
So we currently have the split titles and summaries at the Attorney General's office. We should have a decision back from them by the 11th, so Monday. Fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. We're not at all waiting impatiently.
Got some work to do.
Yes, we do. And then once we have that decision, we've got our petition tracking system in place. We've got that logistical component in ready to go, and we can move on to getting the physical petition books printed and distributed so that Ohioans can start signing and saying, yes, I want to be able to have a choice in how our Ohio Constitution protects us.
Now, you'll have to get 414,000 valid signatures verified. That's 10% of the vote in the prior gubernatorial election, for folks to know why that number is what it is.
Yeah.
Are you confident you can get that for two amendments?
Yes. In part because most people, when we have been talking with them about these topics, they understand that these two things are very much connected. They also understand that, especially once we get into more conversation and talking about, well, what's lacking in Ohio's Constitution, they understand the need for bringing this here. Some of the classes that we list as protected go above and beyond what are currently protected under federal statute and are incredibly impactful for Ohioans. We have heard for years now about the addiction epidemic in Ohio and being able to protect folks from being harmed by their status in recovery. And I want to be clear, behavior is different than identity. So if someone is coming into their job drunk, that's not the same as an employer saying,
you have a past.
Those are two different things. The amendment and those equal rights apply to the identity, not the behavior. So being able to help Ohioans hold jobs and not have their past held against them as they try to rebuild their future and present, that's a good thing that impacts so many people.
Which election are you shooting for?
We are aiming for 2026.
November or May?
November.
And is the reason of that because of large voter turnout?
It's in part timing. It's in part making sure that we can get these protections in place sooner rather than later. Time lost is more people potentially suffering harm from the lack of these protections.
And so by basically you'll have to have these signatures then by next July 1st or so in order to get it on the 2026 November election. Well, Lise Regula, thank you so much for coming in for to update us on the situation right there. Of course, we'll continue to track it here on Face the State and on 10 TV News.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for your time.
Glad to be here.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.